This is a special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Carrie Young, in for Tiziana Deering. As the nation marks its Independence Day, for many of us, it also means celebrating the start of summer. Long days in the sun, maybe some time at the beach, backyard barbecues, and reading. Summer is a great time to catch up on those books you've been meaning to get to, but just haven't had the time to crack open yet. So, with that in mind, we're bringing you a special hour dedicated to summer reading, featuring conversations with some of the most interesting authors we've talked to this year, and some recommendations of what to read next, straight from the experts. Later this hour, we'll hear from Tamar Haspel, a James Beard Award-winning columnist from The Washington Post, who joined us in April to talk about her book, To Boldly Grow, Find Joy, Adventure, and Dinner in Your Own Backyard. It's born out of her quest to eat at least one thing she grew, foraged, or hunted for herself at every meal, and it's full of stories about mushrooms, ice fishing, and fig trees. And what was the oddest creation born out of her journey?
We gotta go with the chicken plucker, because, you know, on the plus side, we didn't burn the house down, but it was nip and tuck there. But it was just another problem to solve. We've got some chickens to pluck, and we wanted to automate the process. You spend some time on YouTube, and then you do your level best. And it's kind of weird that when you spend a lot of time doing things you've never done before, you fail. But that's part of the process.
We'll also get some great reading recommendations from an expert panel, including Catherine Nazzaro, manager and bookseller at Porter Square Books.
Seeing people come into the store and see their favorite books that like they own and they've read before 100 times. I've seen people like lovingly stroke the spine. I've seen people jump up and down and like clap a little, and it's all by themselves, but it's like seeing an old friend again.
But first, we start with a true story with harrowing stakes. Elena Lomborsky, who now lives in Cambridge, emigrated to the United States with her mother from Soviet Russia in her late teens. But that's not where her story begins. Elena and her family were essentially trapped in the Soviet Union for years, her mother imprisoned on false charges, and her grandmother aging alone far from home. Years later, Elena and her mother, Galena, have written a memoir about their lives in Russia and their gradual yet dramatic escape. It's called Like a Drop of Ink in a Downpour, Memories of a Soviet Russia. Elena joined us on the show in June, and she started her conversation with Radio Boston host Tiziana Deering by explaining the excerpt we asked her to read on the show.
So I'm 11 years old. And my mother and I are living in Leningrad, St. Petersburg, Russia, Soviet Russia, and it's 1981, and we are about to emigrate. It was almost impossible to leave Russia, but Soviet Jews were able to get the special permission with a lot of difficulty, and my mother was able to get it. And, you know, we are giving away our things, and we are getting ready to go. And then I come back from school and see three men of Soviet police raid our home, turning our furniture, our pillows, going through my personal things. When they leave, they take away our exit visa. We cannot leave Russia. They charge my mother with a crime. It's a fabricated crime. She's innocent. Everyone tells us that she will be acquitted. And so in the morning, September 81, she is leaving, and I'm staying home waiting for her to come back. So this is an excerpt. A knock on the door, a muffled tentative thud. Not mama's. She did not let me come with her to the trial. You don't need to see the circus. But some advised her, take the child for leniency and compassion of the jury. Like hell they will have compassion, she said. I watched from my window as she walked down the muddy footpath, stepping on islands of broken concrete. She went towards Leninsky Avenue metro station and did not detour to Shislyva, Lucky Street, even though I asked her to. That's too bad, I thought. She turned around to face me and kept walking backward. Good luck, good luck, I yelled out so she could hear me, and then quietly so that luck would fly to her like a swarm of bees. I waved to her hard so I would feel pain in my wrists, just in case. I would recognize Mama's footsteps, rap-a-tap, with echoing of the stairway, the loud smooch of her plum handbag against the door, her keys giggling inside it, playing hide-and-seek with her hands. The door would swing open, and she would sail on a blistering wind with plans and ideas, new assignments for me, and a review of everything I had done in her absence. This knock is not hers. I open the door as Zhenya, one of Mama's many work friends. Zhenya stands on our landing, thumbing her wrinkly purse, crossing and uncrossing her feet in short booties, trimmed with a thin strip of fur. She can tip over standing like this, I think. Zhenya, once a school teacher, now a hairdresser. Standing before me, she's rustling in her mind through pages of textbooks on preteen psychology, readying for a difficult heart-to-heart conversation. I cut her off. Should I get my things?
Like hell, they will have deep compassion. When you read that line, it's your mother's line, but you read it mad. That was 41 years ago. Are you angry?
Yes. Yes, I'm angry. And I have to tell you that it was very difficult to write this story, and I was writing it for some 10 years. And then in January, I had to give my first talk on Arlington Author Salon. And this is the piece I wanted to read. And as I was practicing, my hands were shaking, and I realized I couldn't say this out loud. So I had to go with something very different. And now I have built up a little bit resistance, and I don't feel it's the story is in me anymore. It's out there.
Why at that time in January was it so hard to read this part out loud?
I think it's almost physical feeling that I had. And I keep thinking of all the interviews that I hear on women who were assaulted, and they cannot come out with their stories for 30 years. And I know why. And I think of this story, even if it wasn't physical assault or abuse, it was emotional abuse of the government, of this man, of the whole sequence of people who have assaulted our autonomy, who have taken away mother from her child. We have to live with this. And I think this book for me was about, writing this book is about justice. When we came here to the United States in 87, we decided not to tell anyone about the story. We wanted to start on a clean slate, and I didn't want to be a victim in this new country. But every once in a while, my mother would tell me that she wants to have this criminal case overturned. She wanted justice. And but what point is to get justice from Putin's Russia when they put hundreds of people to prison on fabricated crimes? And so I think writing this story for me was to bring that justice. So every time someone reads this book, I feel that some of this is restored to her, some of decency, and the name is cleared.
So the book, for listeners, the first half or so is written from your perspective. And then we get a chunk of that same story from your mother's perspective, and then we come back to you in the end as you're preparing to finally emigrate. And what's striking, I mean, there are many things striking about it. One thing that's striking about it, you just talked about 1981, this happened. 7 years later, 6 years later, 1987, you emigrate. You know that recurring nightmare people will have where they keep trying to get somewhere and they can't get there. So much of this book feels like that nightmare, which is something I think everyone can understand. And yet, this is so much worse than I think most anyone who hasn't had a similar experience could understand.
Yeah, the feeling I remember, you know, people always ask or assume that, you know, were you scared? Were you frightened? I don't remember being frightened. I don't remember fear. But I think you said exactly, pinpointed that feeling, that it was this sense of being trapped. And I remember growing up with that since I was, you know, 8. We started to apply and we couldn't. So we couldn't plan. We couldn't make any future. The Russian expression is you just live out of a suitcase. And at the same time, while you're just hoping and living in your heart somewhere else, you also have to make a life and carry on your day-to-day and, you know, get educated and have future. I think art was a big part of helping me take myself out of that entrapment.
You studied art later in the story, a little later in your childhood, but art is at part of the heart of this story because of your grandfather Felix's paintings. And I am struck by the undercurrent of this entire story, which is the desire to take those paintings out of the Soviet Union and someplace where they'll be fully seen, fully appreciated. And your family gives up a lot to do that. I mean, your grandmother is separated, goes to the States, really in stewardship of some paintings. And I, as a reader, I struggled with that. There was a piece of me that was like, wow, that's, you know, so important. And there was a piece of me that's like, they're paintings. So talk about that a little.
This is very interesting. I think that in Russia, in the Soviet Union, art is freedom. And art is the way to tell the truth. And I think that is the belief that my family had through art, through music, through poetry. Dissidents, protesters could express their thoughts and they could fight against the system. I spent my first year in my grandfather's studio.
As a baby?
Yeah. And I think my first pre-conscious memories were formed by the colors, by the objects of his art. And then after he died, we lived in a small two-bedroom apartment, and we had 500 paintings also sharing this space. I grew up in a new part of Leningrad, which is very monochrome. But when the paintings came out of their storage in our living room, would burst in color. And some of his work was were collected by art museums, but many of his nonconformist works could not be exhibited. And so the only place to see them were in our home. And I remember whenever guests would come, my grandmother and I would move the furniture around and we would stack these paintings against the walls. And I remember the reverence with which guests would come and watch and look at those paintings.
There was one that really struck me. And it's interesting that you talk about this riot of color, because the painting that we have an image of that really struck me is Portrait of a Boy, circa 1942 through 46. And it looks not like a portrait of a boy to me, but a portrait of what a country can do to a boy. And I wonder, was your grandfather's art considered dissident at any point? Nonconformist is one thing, and that's the phrase you used.
Yes.
What does it mean to be nonconformist?
Nonconformist, I think, to me is dissident. Because in Russia, in the Soviet Union, all art had to conform to socialist realism, right? It was the style that was required by the government. It was propaganda. Artists were required to show happy and healthy, strong workers, the kind of utopia that did not exist in real life. And just to tell the truth, just to show the mundane, the misery, the dirt, was already something that was not allowed. But if you go a next step and show paintings and subjects that were prohibited, if you turn to expressionist, if you go away from figurative realist style, that was dissident, and people could be put to prison, could be executed for just that kind of protest.
Art permeates this story, and it's not just your grandfather's paintings. It's not just you talking about you going to art classes as you got a little older. There's poetry that your mother wrote. The memoir itself is a piece of art, and even your mother's letters coming from prison to you read like poetry. So you've brought a couple things that I'm going to have you read, but the one I want to have you read now is the poem from which the name of the book, Like a Drop of Ink in a Downpour, comes from. So tell us just briefly about the poem and read it for us.
When we already had most of the memoir, we were looking for a good title and everything just didn't quite fit. And then I found a poem that my mother wrote before I was born, when she was in her early 20s. And the poem is called Memory. And the spirit of it anticipated the turn of her life in the for the next 15, 20 years. And there was just a perfect line, like a drop of ink in a downpour, как капля чернил в ливне. So I'll read just an excerpt of that. And again, the black of the waves splashes along the Neva. The air choked with smoke and soot, the bulkheads poisonous red, those cold winter mornings, the funnels giving off their ominous steam, and the powerful vaults of iron towering over me. Like a drop of ink in a downpour, these memories blur and dissolve, but the smoky factory funnel still reaches up a black hand.
How long after you came to the United States did you stop feeling like that smoky black hand could reach you and trap you?
That's a very interesting question. I don't know. I think part of me is still feeling that. It's not the hand of Putin or Soviet Russia. I want to say that these experiences made me stronger. I think that anger is really not an anger, but a fire that propels me to do everything that I do, to get my education, to write this book, to push through many difficult things that come your way in life. I'm grateful for this experience. However, I think there is always, you know, it's always there. You always look and trying to prevent some disaster. And in your mind, it may exist only in your mind. So I think you never stop.
I lost my mom a few years ago. And in her passing, right, you spend your time thinking about the things that you remember about them. But you also start, I don't know how to explain it, you have room to tell yourself the whole story about your past with your mother. And I found myself thinking about that when you go see your mom for the first time when she's in jail, in prison. You see her down the hall and she looks vibrant and she looks healthy and she looks strong and you think it's okay. And then you get up close and you see her teeth and you talk about the malnutrition and the destruction that are visible in her teeth. And you go on to talk about everything you believe she will no longer have in life afterward, like kissing someone because of those teeth. And it is striking to me to think of you thinking of your mom in both of those ways at the same time. How hard was it in telling her story next to yours now to look at your mom in all those ways and tell this story?
I am amazed at my mother for allowing me to speak about her in third tense. She did not want to write this memoir. It came from me. She wanted to write a book about my grandfather, and we got that done. And after that, that cleared the way for me to, in my mind, to write about this. And I think that anything you write to have any meaning has to be honest. And I didn't want to write a polished book, and it has to be true. I started writing what I remembered. I didn't expect to write about those things, but I remember seeing other prisoners who spend years. And no matter whether you spend a year or 10 years in Soviet prison, the first thing you will know is that those people have this teeth. And it's the mark that the crime of this incarceration, that this mark remains the most visible part of right on your body. It's like a tattoo that you can never remove. And my mother, when I finally told her that I'm writing it, first reaction was, no, why do you need to go to all these painful memories? Why do we need to relive this? But not only that, she also gave me her interviews. And when she started speaking, 30 years later after it happened, her memories were completely, perfectly intact, as if she was reliving them every day. And that was remarkable for me.
What does art mean for you now?
I don't know. I don't know what art means for me anymore. We still have this collection, and we spent some 25 years writing, researching my grandfather's work, writing about it, organizing exhibition. I think those paintings that we have are family members and not objects. And that's why it's so difficult to decide where to place them, where their home should be.
I'm going to widen out, if you'll forgive me, from your story to a story now that we're all watching, which is the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the war there. One of the things that struck me in the book is how matter-of-fact you are. There are these little sidebars throughout the book when there are transitions of power in the Soviet Union, right? So we get Brezhnev to Andropov to Chernenko to Gorbachev, and they're like these little footnotes, even though geopolitically to those in the United States, and I grew up in that time, they seemed like earthquakes. So now we have Vladimir Putin. You're writing this book. It comes out. I'm sure it's not like you were planning to release it around the time of a Russian-invoked war. How are you feeling watching that from here happen there? And are there lessons here in this book that we can take?
Yeah. The KGB is back in power. And I think the biggest opportunity lost for when the Soviet Union fell apart is that the KGB was allowed to remain in power. There were other countries of the Eastern Bloc that had opened their archives, that removed their secret service agents, that perhaps opened and were open and honest about stories of the crime. I want to say that we tend to pin these devastating things, these crimes, on individuals, Putin's war, Stalin's terror. But I believe that it is 100 years of secret services, the NKVD, the KGB, and now FSB, that has been terrorizing the country. This war is devastating. I think it's a crime. It's an invasion. I think that I speak for all Russian-speaking community in the diaspora community in Boston and elsewhere, that we stand with Ukraine. I think the world needs to support Ukraine and to push back this criminal invasion. I think also for me, when I stop and think that these Russian soldiers may be children of my classmates, how can I wish them dead? I think that this war is destroying Russia as much as it is destroying the physical, you know, cities of Ukraine and the taking life on all sides. I hope that there is a better future, and I hope that somehow these terrible events will catalyze the young generation in Russia who will go to protest, who know, who have seen democracy, and that there is a better future for Russia.
Ultimately, you emigrated, and you're here. In the arc of your life, where is home?
Oh, it's in Boston. It's in Cambridge.
Why?
It's just the perfect place to be. I love Boston. I love everything about it. It's a beautiful city. It has wonderful people. I'm grateful every day to live here.
That was Elena Lomborski, co-author of the memoir Like a Drop of Ink in a Downpour, Memories of Soviet Russia. That conversation originally aired in June, and you can find more information, including pictures of some of Elena's grandfather's artwork, at our website, radioboston.org. Stay with us. Coming up, how a journey to eat one thing she either grew, foraged, or hunted as part of every meal led James Beard Award-winning columnist Tamar Haspel to a project turning an old washing machine into a chicken plucker. I'm Carrie Young. This is Radio Boston. You're listening to a special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Carrie Young, in for Tiziana Deering. And with Independence Day marking the unofficial start of summer for many of us, we're taking the time to help fill out your summer reading list, revisiting some of our favorite conversations about books from earlier this year. Before the break, we heard Cambridge-based author Elena Lomborski reflecting on her experience emigrating from the Soviet Union to the United States, including an unscheduled delay after her mother was arrested and imprisoned over false charges. Now, we turn to another book that's just as compelling, but for totally different reasons. Tamar Haspel is a James Beard Award-winning columnist for The Washington Post. She writes the column Unearthed, which she says tackles food from every angle. Haspel moved to the Cape in 2008 and, with trepidation at first, set out to eat one thing she grew, foraged, or hunted for herself at every meal. 14 years and a whole lot of mushrooms, bad-tasting greens, trucks, guns, ice fishing, chicken pluckers, and one fig tree later, she wrote a book, To Boldly Grow: Finding Joy, Adventure, and Dinner in Your Own Backyard. Haspel joined us in studio back in April to talk about her book and her journey. And Radio Boston host Tiziana Deering started by asking her about the most unusual, inventive thing Haspel had to create along the way in order to succeed on her quest.
We got to go with the chicken plucker because, you know, on the plus side, we didn't burn the house down, but it was nip and tuck there. But it was just another problem to solve. We've got some chickens to pluck, and we wanted to automate the process. You spend some time on YouTube, and then you do your level best. And it's kind of weird that when you spend a lot of time doing things you've never done before, you fail. But that's part of the process. And now we have a chicken plucker that doesn't burn the house down and actually does pluck chickens. And a story to boot.
So for the burn the house down thing, the engine on the washing machine eventually caught on fire.
It did.
Right. And so for people to understand, because this was hard for me to picture until you really described it. Basically, you've got rubber grabby thingies in something that spins.
That's the technical term.
Right. And you stick the chicken in there and the rubber grabby thingies grab all the feathers and pull them off.
Yes, I think that's an excellent description. Yeah, there are these rubber, and they call them chicken fingers, which caused a little confusion right at the beginning of this story. But yeah, and so, and you can either do a drum and put the chicken on the inside, or you can have a rotating cylinder and hold the chicken on the outside. So, but either way, it's the same process. The rubber grabby thingies grab the chicken feathers, and they work pretty well. And when you're doing chickens, you generally have quite a few, and it makes the process go a lot more smoothly.
So this was an interesting thing about your journey towards really producing or foraging or growing or raising more and more of your own food, that the book really moves back and forth between the control room wants to know, make sure the chicken is dead. At that point, it is. And in fact, that's the thing I'm going to talk about right now. You go back and forth between the humor and the ingenuity and the trying and the failure, but also the sacredness for you of the plants, the animals, the land, you know, the respect with which you approach all of this. Talk about that a little bit.
It connects you to where food comes from, which is something I think a lot of us have moved really far away from. And I think we have a better feel of it with plants because a lot of us, you know, we grow tomatoes in the garden. But with animals, it's a little bit harder. Most of us don't keep livestock. Most of us have never killed an animal we're going to eat. And some of the most moving experiences we had were actually when we had flocks of turkeys and people would want to come down on slaughter day and participate because they felt like if they were going to eat meat, and a lot of these people wanted to opt out of the industrial food supply but felt differently about a backyard-raised bird, and they felt like if they were going to eat meat, they wanted to step up and actually do the slaughter themselves. And there were some experiences on those days that really stuck with me. And of course, the very experience of doing it myself. It was the hardest thing that I've ever had to do, but it's also commensurately satisfying. And to this day, you can ask me, you know, what's a skill you're proud of? And I work real hard to be a better writer and a better cook and even a better golfer. But what I'm proud of is that I can shoot and field dress and break down a deer because it was so far out of my comfort zone.
So I will come back to the deer because that whole piece is a really interesting story. But I'm going to back us up now because when you started, there were two things that really stuck with me. One, the word armchair comes up a lot at the beginning because you were kind of an armchair person.
I was.
This is not an armchair sport.
It is not.
Right. And then the other thing is that you started in a simple place that was just a little bit of growing and a little bit of foraging. In fact, really foraging that first year when you set out to say, what if I produced for myself, and I'm not sure produce is exactly the right word, one thing I eat every time. Mm-hmm. So take us back to the beginning to a less intimidating place for somebody who might want to join you in this endeavor now.
And both the key and the object lesson is to start small. And that's what we did. And I started doing this because my husband and I had left Manhattan and we moved to Cape Cod. I write about food and I wanted an interesting project. And we had already started a garden and I was interested in the other options. And so we undertook to do this, but we did start small. It started with clamming, which here in the Boston area and on Cape Cod, you can do. It started with learning which mushrooms won't kill you. And only after we did a couple of those easier things, and it could be something as simple as starting one of those hydroponic herb gardens on your windowsill. But what draws you in is the feeling that that food that you're invested in, that you've gotten your hands dirty growing or procuring, it's different from other food. And anyone who's ever grown a tomato has this sense, or caught a trout. And so I started looking around for the next thing. And of course, it snowballed. It got bigger and bigger. And, you know, before you know it, I'm getting a shotgun and a crew cut for my 45th birthday.
All right. So listen, I want to do a lightning round here of some of the simple lessons that I learned from your book that I think our listeners might like. And I'm going to start with foraging. Can I eat it? Right. In the green plant space, taste, yes? Taste
is how you tell. Absolutely. Taste is how you tell. And most things that are good to eat also taste good. So if it tastes bitter, it might have compounds in it that are not good for you. So be careful. So you don't have to be so careful with those. But be careful with fruit.
Yes. So fruit, taste not your guide.
No, you have to know which fruits are edible and which aren't. And there are lots of books that can tell you that.
Okay. Now, mushrooms were interesting because what I'd gleaned from you is there are books that can tell you that, but good luck matching the mushroom you see to the book.
Mushrooms are a little difficult, and I understand why people are trepidatious because, like, the upside is a nice soup and the downside is an excruciating death. And so you go somewhere else. But I will tell you that mushrooms are the single tastiest things you can forage, and there are a few that are easy to identify that have no deadly lookalikes that you're totally safe bringing home and experimenting with.
Name a couple of those.
Well, the best one is a hen of the wood. And if you can find one of those, any of those lobed mushrooms that look like that, they look like giant brains, are not going to kill you. But then there's also chanterelles and black trumpets in this part of the wood world. And we don't have morels on Cape Cod. Maybe some of you have them in the Boston area. And if you do, I'm going to give you my phone number because I would really like to come mushrooming with you in the spring.
Now, before people, though, get a little overwhelmed at the thought of even having to go mushrooming, if I remember correctly, you found the hen of the wood outside an old nightclub.
It was by a parking lot. Yeah, by a music venue on Cape Cod. And it's because my husband has bionic peripheral vision. When we lived in Cape Cod, he was a commodity trader, and he looked on the floor and he gestured and he had to know what was going on in the whole ring. And it was perfect training for mushroom hunting because we passed that mushroom at 35 miles an hour arguing about politics. And he goes, "Did you see that?" I'm like, "No, of course I didn't see that." So we circled back, and then that tree kept on giving for a number of years.
So I want to come back to the deer now. So now we fast forward, because this was a 14-year process, and in it is a lot of experimentation about how to really do this yourself, where to save money, like on garden
right.
beds, and where you can't, like on a boat, if
right.
you're going to fish. Go ahead.
So the great thing about this endeavor is that it meets you where you are. It whatever your level of financial commitment is, whatever your schedule is, whether you have kids or you have a partner or you're solo, whether you're urban or rural, there's something you can do. And you get to pick the thing. Maybe it is just the hydroponic herb garden on the windowsill. Maybe it's one of those mushroom kits. Maybe it's a weekend mushroom hunt. But yeah, there's some things like if you want to fish, you need first fish equipment. And if you want to go after them other than from shore, you need a boat. And that's really the only part of the book where money comes in.
So I will encourage people to read the deer hunting portion. And I will tell you, I was raised in a family that hunted. I learned to hunt as a kid.
Did you really?
Yeah. So this registered with me in a different way. What really struck me in the piece I want to ask you about here was you really choosing to cross the threshold, both to learn to use a gun and to shoot a deer, which really felt, in the way you described it, categorically different. So why cross that threshold? Why not just stop short?
That's a great question. And I did stop short of the threshold until it occurred to me that part of the point of doing this was I was pushing my boundaries. I was learning new things. I was acquiring new skills. And the only reason I didn't want to go out and hunt a deer was basically because I was a sniveling weenie. And I didn't want to be a sniveling weenie. And so I stepped up and decided to do it. And it was very difficult for me. I mean, a whole lifetime of watching Wild Kingdom, I'm totally team gazelle. And here I am going out in the woods with a firearm trying to hunt down a deer. And it was a very big step for me. But as I said, it was commensurately gratifying.
Has anyone ever said to you, just don't? just only eat the fruits and vegetables and mushrooms and just don't eat the meat.
Absolutely. And there are a lot of people who are categorically opposed to killing animals to eat them. And I talk about that a little bit in the book. That's a principled stand, and I admire it, although I don't share it. But a lot of people who don't eat meat actually, sort of ironically, opt out of it for the same reason that some hunters hunt. I've had hunters tell me that they hunt deer because they want the animal they eat to have had a good life, and they don't want to get what's available in the supermarket. So, you know, hunters hunt sometimes for the same reason vegans veg. And so there's a whole lot more human connection in the world of food than I think there is in other parts of the world right now.
So I'm looking at this dozen beautiful eggs that you brought here. They're gorgeous from your chickens. And in our last minute, what I want to ask you is, when I use the word precious, I mean dear, not sweet. What right. is the most precious aspect of having developed this approach to your life for you?
The most precious aspect is the one that surprised me the most, was that it changed me. It made me a more capable person. It made me a person who gets things done. It made me a person who spends time on the steep part of the learning curve, who isn't afraid of a new challenge. And at a time in my life where, let's face it, my powers are declining, that's a really good place to be.
And that's a really good place to end. Tamara Haspel is author of To Boldly Grow, Finding Joy, Adventure, and Dinner in Your Own Backyard. Tamara, really enjoyed the conversation and the book. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Stay with us. Coming up, we'll get some book recommendations from a couple of experts. I'm Carrie Young. This is Radio Boston. You're listening to a special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Carrie Young, in for Tiziana Deering. And as folks across the country gather to celebrate Independence Day and to mark the unofficial start of summer, we are taking some time today to help you out with that summer reading list, revisiting some of our favorite conversations about books from this year. We heard earlier this hour from a couple of authors, Elena Lombersky, who co-wrote the memoir Like a Drop of Ink in a Downpour, Memories of Soviet Russia, and Tamara Haspel, James Beard Award-winning columnist for The Washington Post and author of To Boldly Grow, Finding Joy, Adventure, and Dinner in Your Own Backyard. But now, we want to turn our focus toward really filling out your list of must-reads. And to help us do that, we checked in with Catherine Nazzaro, manager and bookseller at Porter Square Books in Cambridge and in Boston, and Caroline Harvey, co-owner of Dogtown Books in Gloucester. They joined us back in March to talk about what they were reading and how revisiting old favorites can be as rewarding as spending time with an old friend, and what they were looking forward to reading this year. Radio Boston host Tiziana Deering started by asking Caroline, what's the book that you cannot put down right now?
Well, I'll tell you that I am desperately awaiting a book that just came out on Tuesday called Bless the Daughter Raised by a Voice in Her Head. It's a full-length poetry collection by Warson Shire, who most people might know because she collaborated with Beyoncé on Lemonade.
Oh, wow. So it's a book that you will not be able to put down when it comes.
I tell you, I can't stop checking my email to find out when it will be delivered.
And Catherine,
I am that excited.
Catherine, what about you? The book you can't put down right now.
I'm also super excited for the Warson Shire book. I read a few poems from it and it's amazing. But for me, the book I can't put down right now is Kaiki by Vaishnavi Patel. It comes out in April from Orbit Books, and it's a retelling of the Ramayana along the lines of Circe, where it takes like a female villain in the story and just gives her point of view of everything. And it's like a 500-page epic story, and I'm 2/3 of the way through it and cannot put it down. It's so wonderful.
So let's talk about the lists you've brought. And I do want to say we've got the full set of your lists on our website at radioboston.org. Folks, you'll be able to go there to look it all up. Caroline, one new friend you'd like to recommend to our listeners today?
Well, I'll start with a book that really does for me feel like a friend. It's a book I've read cover to cover twice, but it's the book I carry with me. Even if I don't think I'll have a chance to read it, it gets packed with me and carried around. And that is a book called Toil and Trouble by Augustine Burroughs. It came out in 2019, and I've recommended it to everyone. If you know Augustine's work, he wrote Running with Scissors and a memoir called Dry. He is a very funny writer and tends to weave memoirs around some tragic and deeply poignant legacies of mental illness in his family. This book, Toil and Trouble, it centers around a through line of what Augustine calls being a witch and his understanding of the supernatural and almost science fiction occurrences that happen in his real life. And he begins to open up this angle of looking at the legacy of family and love and the way we create our own families with this idea of openness to the mystic in a way that is so real and so funny and so appealing to anyone with a little bit of cynicism. He starts the book by talking about what he doesn't believe in and then kind of reluctantly and hilariously admits that kind of against his own will, he is in fact a witch. And the book takes place where they Augustine and his husband and their pack of wily dogs are moving out of New York City, which is this huge moment of change and grief and the unknown. And they move to a more rural landscape where they have a bunch of land. And
so let's stop it there. Not that I mean, it's fascinating, but A, I don't want to give too much away. And B, I want to make room for some other recommendations. But again, that is Toil and Trouble by Augustine Burroughs. Yes.
Yes, and you can tell it's like my best friend. I can't stop talking about it. So I mean, thanks for cutting me off.
No, that's okay. And thanks for being good about it. But that is what makes a book fantastic when you just want everybody to know. So that book you're going to put on the list, Catherine.
So for me, it's going to be Act Your Age, Eve Brown by Talia Hibbert, which is the third in the Brown Sisters series, which is a series of romance novels. For me, books that are romance novels are like the ultimate old friend books, because even if the story is different, romance novels follow a very specific like guideline. You have the get together, you have like about two thirds of the way through, you have a turn, you have a definite happy ending. So even when you're looking at a new book, it's always, you know what you're expecting, which I feel is very comforting. I sped through this series, and this specific one is about Eve, who is the youngest daughter, and has always kind of been treated like a baby. She's in her mid-20s and decides that it is time for her to get her act together and like grow up a little bit. And she starts working at a bed and breakfast after she hit the owner with her car. And it is about the two of them developing a relationship. And because it's the third book in the series, the first two being about her other two sisters, you get a lot of the old characters coming back. And it's like seeing your old friends and seeing how those relationships have developed into them being a part of the family.
So that's Act Your Age, Eve Brown by Talia Hibbert, yes?
Yes.
All right. We've got a couple callers who'd like to make recommendations. Megan's on the line in Duxbury. Go ahead, Megan.
Hi, Tiziana. I have a book I'm totally obsessed with, and just had it, gave it to my whole book group, and they all were too. It's called Why Fish Don't Exist by Lulu Miller. And maybe your speakers have heard of it. It's a nonfiction read by, she actually works at NPR Invisibilia program, and it is a brilliant short read that packs a punch and a surprise and a twist and a turn. I can't recommend it enough.
Fantastic, Megan. Thank you so much. Have either of you happened to have heard of it, Catherine or Caroline?
I have definitely heard of, I haven't read it yet, but it is one of the books that, like, when it first came out, everybody wanted to be reading that book. It's definitely high on a lot of people's lists.
Fantastic. All right. Ben, quickly in Cambridge. Ben, what's your recommendation?
Hi, Tiziana. I love anything by John Bellairs. So he was a wonderful children's book author. He wrote a couple adult novels as well. But to tie both parts of your second together, I used to, in second grade, go to the library in school to check to see if there were any new John Bellairs books on the shelves. And he had three different series for kids, all of them wonderful, usually a child who befriends an older adult. And there's a lot of mystery and occult involved, and they're just delightful, warm, friendly stories. So those were some of my best friends growing up.
Wonderful. Thanks, Ben. And Caroline, I know that you also brought a YA recommendation. Maybe you can briefly tell us about that.
I can, and it's definitely YA. It is a board book, so really you could bring this to a child as, you know, as young as two or three. It's called A is for Activist by Inosanto Nagara, and it came into our store, and everyone fell in love with it. Everyone picked it up, and like Catherine was saying, it was one of those books where people had a visceral reaction to it. They were facial expressions changing and hands clapping. It's a familiar device. It's an alphabet book. You know, A is for apples, B is for bananas. It rhymes. There's a lot of alliteration, but it is unapologetically progressive. And the words are, for example, A is for activist, but it's also for ally, for advocate. And it was written by the author to really fill a gap in a book that was educational and political with really layered illustrations so you could return again and again to these words and kind of, as I said, unapologetically getting these words of social justice and civil rights into the vocabulary of young people. And it's so special.
Fantastic. All right. We have a little less than a minute left. So, Catherine, back to you. A title coming out later this year that you're looking for.
The Hacienda by Isabel Cañas is coming out later this year. Fans of Mexican Gothic are going to love this book. It's a little Gothic novel that takes place in Mexico during the Mexican Civil War, about similar to Daphne du Maurier's Rebecca. It's about a woman who becomes the second wife of this rich man, goes to his home and finds out that it is just incredibly haunted. One of my friends tweeted about this book, and I immediately like downloaded the advanced copy, read it immediately. It's just
fantastic.
All encompassing.
That was Catherine Nazzaro, manager and bookseller at Porter Square Books in Cambridge and in Boston, and Caroline Harvey, co-owner of Dogtown Books in Gloucester. They talked with Radio Boston's Tiziana Deering back in March about what they were reading and what they're looking forward to reading this year. You can find both of their lists on our website at radioboston.org. Well, that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick, Amanda Beeland, and Sydney Bowles, with Maya Schwader and Amy Moon. Marquise Neal is our technical director. Titus Faladin is our executive producer. I'm Carrie Young. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston, and from all of us, we hope you have a great Independence Day.